So I went across the courtyard and I cut up an apple. And if you, in India, if you feed somebody with anger in your heart, it's like feeding them poison. That's why I honor that in the kitchen here at Esalen, there are holy pictures and there's music that all takes the cooking staff and the baking staff and helps them arrive in a consciousness where they imbue the food with some kind of love and some kind of conscious endeavor and investment. If you assume that stuff that is cooked over fire receives the vibrations of the person cooking it, and then think of where you eat. Think of where you eat. No wonder. No wonder. So I cut up an apple, and then I went up to each person to offer the apple, knowing I had to offer it with love. And I could feel the tenacity of the anger. Because usually when you've been angry at somebody and you want to, quote, make up with them, you sit down and talk it out until everybody's saved enough face. Do you know how that's done? You know, let's talk it out. And then you were so good to talk it out, they say, well, I really appreciate you talking it out. And everybody got a little something out of it. Everybody's ego came out whole. But he didn't say to protect my ego. He said to give up anger. He just said give up anger. If you got a guru, that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to do what the guru said. There are a lot of things he said I haven't done, but that's... takes time. And each time I let go of the anger, and then I fed, it took me about an hour and a half to feed all the people. One piece of apple. Several weeks later, it's the end of the story that I told the other night, the other day. Several weeks later, I was angry at Maharaji. And Maharaji, Ramdas, you gonna feed me some apple? It's like Kabir's line, do what you do with another human being, but never put them out of your heart. Think of all the people you put out of your heart. Because you forget the plane of reality where you love them because you're so caught in the other plane. It's like when you play tennis or any game, any competitive sport, you are competing with your opponent in the game. But you notice you both went on the court to play tennis together. So in a way, you are collaborating to compete. And what's called a good sport is somebody that remembers that there are those two planes of reality simultaneously. If you lose one of them, you're not considered a good sport. If you just want to win so bad that you are really angry and furious and put down the other person, that's not a good sport. And if you just are so collaborative that you give them the game, that isn't a good sport. I remember going to see a publisher who was going to publish The Only Dance There Is. He turned out to be a very dear friend, Bill Whitehead, who just died last week of AIDS, actually. And this was back in the early 70s, and I went into Bill's office, and Bill was working for Doubleday at the time. And the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology had arranged to publish this book with them without me having to do with it, even though I had written it. So I went in to work out some kind of a contract with them. And I was bearded and beads and so on, still. And I sat down, how do you do, Bill? And I sat down and I saw immediately that his mind had categorized me as a kind of a new age, spiritual type, and it would be really easy to get a good contract with him. I mean, I saw his mind do that. And I said, Bill, I said, I suspect you and I are going to be very good friends. I suspect we're going to know each other deeply. And we did. I said, but at this moment, you and I are negotiating about a contract. And we have to play our game impeccably, and I'd just like you to know I'm going to screw you to the wall. It was the capacity to live on two dimensions simultaneously, two planes of reality simultaneously. To not put somebody out of your heart and at the same point compete with them or oppose them. The amount of anger in the anti-Vietnam movement, which came out of unconsciousness, perpetuated a polarization in this culture that we are still experiencing at this moment. Nobody's to blame. This is just the way phenomena unfold. And this is a story I've read many times, but the essence of it has to do with the quality of listening. On the bulletin board in the front hall of the hospital where I work, there appeared an announcement. Yeshe Dondon, it read, will make rounds at 6 o'clock on the morning of June 10. The particulars were then given, followed by a notation. Yeshe Dondon is personal physician to the Dalai Lama. I am not so leathery a skeptic that I would knowingly ignore an emissary from the gods. This is the doctor writing. Not only might such sang-froid be inimical to one's earthly well-being, it could take care of eternity as well. Thus, on the morning of June 10, I joined the clutch of white coats waiting in the small conference room adjacent to the ward selected for the round. The air in the room is heavy with ill-concealed dubiety and suspicion of bamboozlement. You can imagine. Grand rounds, we're going to hear this Tibetan Lama do it. At precisely 6 o'clock, he materializes, a short, golden, barrelly man dressed in a sleeveless robe of saffron and maroon. His scalp is shaven, and the only visible hair is a scanty black line above each hooded eye. He bows in greeting while his young interpreter makes the introduction. Yeshe Dondon, we are told, will examine a patient selected by a member of the staff. The diagnosis is unknown to Yeshe Dondon as it is to us. The examination of the patient will take place in our presence, after which we will reconvene in the conference room where Yeshe Dondon will discuss the case. We are further informed that for the past 2 hours, Yeshe Dondon has purified himself by bathing, fasting, and prayer. I, having breakfasted well, performed only the most desultory of ablutions, and given no thought at all to my soul, glance furtively at my fellows. Suddenly we seem a soiled, uncouth lot. The patient has been awakened early and told that she was to be examined by a foreign doctor and had been asked to produce a fresh specimen of urine. So when we enter her room, the woman shows no surprise. She has long ago taken on that mixture of compliance and resignation that is the face of chronic illness. This was to be but another in the endless series of tests and examinations. Yeshe Dondon steps to the bedside while the rest stand apart watching. For a long time he gazes at the woman, favoring no part of her body with his eyes, but seeming to fix his glance at a place just above her supine form. I too study her, and no physical sign or obvious symptom gives a clue to the nature of her disease. At last he takes her hand, raising it in both of his own. Now he bends over the bed in a kind of crouching stance, his head drawn down into the collar of his robe. His eyes are closed and he feels for her pulse. In a moment he has found the spot, and for the next half hour he remains thus, suspended above the patient like some exotic golden bird with folded wings, holding the pulse of the woman beneath his fingers, cradling her hand in his. All the powers of the man seem to have been drawn down into this one purpose. It is palpitation of the pulse raised to the state of ritual. From the foot of the bed where I stand, it is as though he and the patient have entered a special place of isolation, of apartness, about which a vacancy hovers and across which no violation is possible. After a moment, the woman rests back upon her pillow. From time to time, she raises her head to look at the strange figure above her, then sinks back once more. I cannot see their hands joined in a correspondence that is exclusive, intimate, his fingertips receiving the voice of her sick body through the rhythm and throb she offers at her wrist. All at once, I am envious. Not of him. Not of Yeshe Dandan for his gift of beauty and holiness, but of her. I want to be held like that, touched so, received. And I know that I, who have palpitated 100,000 pulses, have not felt a single one. At last, Yeshe Dandan straightens, gently places the woman's hand upon the bed and steps back. The interpreter produces a small wooden bowl and two sticks. Yeshe Dandan pours a portion of the urine specimen into the bowl and proceeds to whip the liquid with a two stick. This he does for several minutes until a foam is raised. Then, bowing over the bowl, he inhales the odor three times. He sets down the bowl and turns to leave. All this while he has not uttered a single word. As he nears the door, the woman raises her head and calls out to him in a voice at once urgent and serene. Thank you, doctor, she says, and touches with her other hand the place he had held on her wrist, as though to recapture something that had visited there. Yeshe Dandan turns back for a moment to gaze at her, then steps into the corridor. Rounds are at an end. We are seated once more in the conference room. Yeshe Dandan speaks now for the first time in soft Tibetan sounds that I have never heard before. He has barely begun when the young interpreter begins to translate, the two voices continuing in tandem, a bilingual fugue, the one chasing the other. It is like the chanting of monks. He speaks of winds coursing through the body of the woman, currents that break against barriers, eddying. These vortices are in her blood, he says, the last spendings of an imperfect heart. Between the chambers of the heart, long, long before she was born, a wind had come and blown open a deep gate that must never be opened. Through it charge the full waters of her river as the mountain stream cascades in the springtime, battering, knocking loose the land and flooding her breath. Thus he speaks and is now silent. May we have the diagnosis now, a professor asks. The host of the rounds, the man who knows, answers, congenital heart disease, interventricular septal defect with resultant heart failure. Exactly the thing. A gateway in the heart, I think. The interventricular septal defect that must not be opened. Through it charge the full waters that flood her breath. So, here then is the doctor listening to the sounds of the body to which the rest of us are deaf. He is more than doctor. He is priest. Now and then it happens as I make my own rounds that I hear the sounds of his voice like an ancient Buddhist prayer, its meaning long since forgotten, only the music remaining. Then a jubilation possesses me and I feel myself touched by something divine. Listening. And how do you listen? You listen by getting out of the place you're standing, because the real listening is what Heinlein talked about in Stranger in a Strange Land in the term grok. When you grok something, where Adam says to the doctor, the doctor says, what does grok mean? Adam says, well, I'll tell you, if one of us cut the other one up and put it in a stew and cooked it and ate it, we would grok one another. And it wouldn't matter who did the eating. The doctor said, it would matter to me. That's the me. Richard Alpert here. That's the me. It would matter to me. But I is grok. I listens. I knows. I knows what's going on. When I sit and listen to somebody, it's interesting what I do. I focus usually on the point between their eyes, right at the middle of their nose. I just sit right there, and I make that just as if that is the focal point of meditation, so that my mind goes into that point and becomes very quiet. And then in the quietness, I'm listening, and I'm hearing not only what they're saying, but I'm feeling them saying it. It's like climbing inside of another being through the quietness of not being busy being you. If you're busy being the listener, you cut yourself off. The art is to hear, but not to listen, in an active sense. And to hear, you have to be quiet in your mind, and any model you have, or any expectation, or any thought to which you are identified, is the agitation of the mind. In Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga, it talks about, and in the Vedas too, citta vritti nirodha, the cessations of the turning of the mind. And if you see the mind as an ocean with little waves on it, the waves are all the thought form. And as long as you're on the top, you're being tossed about. The minute you're not grabbing at these thought forms, you start to sink down and you're just sitting in the ocean like one of those big fish that's just sitting there. You begin to hear everything out of the quietness of your being. You keep hearing more than you ever heard before. It's interesting when somebody dies and somebody else is grieving. Their grieving is a set of models they have in their mind. They're busy missing somebody. That's a clinging to a model of what was a moment ago. You'll notice how suffering has to do with that quality of the clinging of mind. You're clinging because there was a time when you didn't know that person, then you knew them, then they're gone. And here you are. And how much do you cling at that moment? But usually after somebody dies, the person keeps rehearsing all the memories of being with them. And they rehearse and they're grabbing and they're filled with self-pity at the thought that being without their friend forever or their loved one. And it goes on and they keep emotionally playing with these thoughts. And they go into depressions and then they go into joy and they cry and they laugh and they... All these waves of grieving. And people come to me and they talk to me about that state, because everybody around them either gets bored with their grieving, or they feel that in order to be good and new age, they shouldn't grieve. So they're busy getting it together. And I always say, go grieve some more. Keep grieving. Grieve for a while. Until you're finished. When you're finished, and you quiet down a little bit, and you're not so busy with all the waves on the top of the ocean, and you quiet down and get down to the deep a little bit, you will see that your beloved is right there, and that nothing really went anywhere. It's only because you're in your thoughts, and thoughts always take objects that you experience that an object is missing. The object of your friend is missing, the subject isn't. The essence isn't missing, the essence is right. If you've tasted essence with another human being for a second, you never have to see them again. It's a hard one. Maharaji, people would come to Maharaji and they would come up, I'd watch them. They'd come up and they would look at him. Some people just saw a funny old man and they left and they got food and they left the temple. But some would come up and they'd look at him. And I'd watch the thing happen, the unconditional love being received, if you will. I'd watch that moment. It was like an electric moment, just a little moment. And the next moment, Maharaji would say, "Jao." Can you imagine just at the moment you've fallen in love? Right? You've just experienced just that little flip of something where before this was another person and suddenly it's the beloved. Just happening at that moment, your beloved says, "Jao" means split, means go away. Do you see how when you taste it, you want to collect more? And people hang around the guru like it's going out of style. And to touch a foot or to see it through a doorway or anything, when you know what it's like with the beloved, my gosh, you bring breakfast to them. Wouldn't do that to anyone else. Ah. Call me by my true name. I think that if you can hear, we live in illusion and the appearance of things. We are that reality. When we understand, then we see that we are nothing. That's not a put down. That's a release. You don't have to be somebody anymore. You can play like you're somebody. Everybody wants you to be somebody so you can be somebody for them, but you don't have to buy it. I don't take me seriously. As I've said, I'm a renter, Ram Dass. I'm a form. I'm a thing. You pump it up and it does its thing. And I'm right here. Hey, I'm here. It's like kids playing ball out on the street. It's like I used to feel after supper, I'd be playing ball and I'd want somebody to come out and play ball with me. And they'd all have their noses pressed against the window and saying, "Mother won't let me come out," or "It's too late," or something. Like nobody wants to come out and play. Everybody's too busy being somebody. And they only want to be with you if you will conspire to reinforce their somebodyness. Okay. I only want to be with you if you'll make believe I am who I think I am. I, in turn, will make believe you are who you think you are. And we'll be friends. Do you realize what you're saying? Friends with what? It's hypocrisy squared. Squared hypocrisy. How many times have you felt like you're inside your role and people see your role and they don't see you? The minute you recognize that you just don't have to be somebody all the time. You know, we go home at the end of the day and we take out our wallet and throw it down or put our bag down or take off our shoes and some quality that we have projected outward, we let go of. And we say, well, now I can be me or what? But even that one, any me you've got is a trap. I have no idea who I am. I don't even care. You realize that statement? You realize how current psychology would hear that statement? I mean, what I kidded about, I said, who I am now, who I was when I was a psychotherapist would consider psychotic, or at least severely neurotic, and would consider hospitalization. I have an imaginary playmate who's been dead for 14 years, who I talk to all the time. I think I'm nobody. I think I'm happy. and I don't even care. And I have no idea what I'll do when I grow up. And I have no age. And I don't anticipate I'll die. Now, if you were a psychotherapist and heard that, if someone walked into your office and presented that, I challenge you not to get caught in your theory of psychodynamics that would interpret that in a certain way. Can you hear that? And I feel, on the other hand, like I have just, somebody has given me a key to the jewel box. And I suddenly realize that I've got all these jewels to play with. I can play with life instead of being played by life. It was just a little flip of something that happened, and suddenly it's all different. All different. And you try to tell somebody and they don't want to hear it. I did it in Be Here Now. I showed a guy running down, screaming at everybody about the truth. You know, and they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it. Except under very delicate conditions.